Hi, everybody. You're back at the Faculty Factory podcast, and I'm Kim Skorupski here at Hopkins looking at my friend and colleague, Miss Valerie Dander. Hi, Valerie.
Hi, Kim. How are you today?
Valerie Dander, she is a director of medical school operations at the Association of American Medical Colleges, or as we call it, the AAMC. And you hear a lot about AAMC, particularly the group on faculty affairs, the best affinity group of the AAMC, right? Can I get a witness? We are the best. We are so fun. We're such a great tight family and a community. And actually, the whole Faculty Factory podcast started because of professional development conferences and the group on faculty affairs and us wanting to build community and talk with each other and learn things and share things. So we're here today because back at the professional development conference this past summer in Palm Springs, California, of course, ran into Valerie. She's always there, always on top of things. And I said, we can't get you on the podcast. And of course, she demurred and no. And I said, no, we're going to get you on. We have to learn more about this standpoint survey. And I remember when I got involved with GFA, Valerie, about 10 or 12 years ago, it was called something else and it changed names. And I remember, unfortunately, the institution I was with then, and even actually now at Hopkins, we don't use the standpoint survey. So I wasn't even really familiar with it other than hearing my colleagues brag about it and saying, darn, how come we can't use it? But I just also want to brag on Valerie a bit. You may have heard me talk about, or if not, I'm a gerontologist, as Valerie knows. And so I was very fortunate to be a part of this big national team where we looked at late career faculty and their expectations for retirement and what our institutions have by ways of policy, programs, and resources. So we surveyed deans about their late career faculty. And Valerie was the go-to person. You have been the key person for so many surveys and initiatives and data analyses and manuscripts and important work. So I just wanted to make sure everybody knew that, amplify you, raise you up for the good work you do. None of that can be done. None of it could be done without Valerie Dander. So Valerie, please drop some wisdom on us. What the heck is standpoint? How did it come about? Why should we care? What's going on? What's important about standpoint?
Thank you so much, Kim, for the kudos and warm welcome. I'm so excited to be with the Faculty Factory today and share a little bit about the Standpoint program at the AAMC. So as you mentioned, we started under a different name, Faculty Forward, back in 2009. And we then changed our name in 2017 to Standpoint Surveys, to be inclusive of the fact that we don't only survey faculty in academic medicine, but also staff members. We believe that staff are as critical as faculty in making our academic medical centers work. And so this is a program by which schools, it's optional, and schools will contract with the AAMC to administer the Standpoint Engagement Survey on their behalf. This is a research validated survey specifically for the academic medicine community. And Standpoint is also the only AAMC data collection that gathers feedback directly from faculty and staff. So some folks might be familiar with the AAMC student surveys, the graduation questionnaire, or the matriculating student questionnaire that gathers feedback from students, but this is akin to that program.
And so you're emphasizing that the data you get are directly from the mouths or the fingers of the faculty and staff, because it's not being administered or channeled through deans or chair people. It's all directly from them. So there's no filtering. So that's kind of really raises the validity, I would think, and the authenticity of what you're hearing, what you're learning, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, because the AAMC is a third party in this process, faculty and staff, you know, have this confidential opportunity to provide feedback. And, you know, because of that, because the measures we have in place to protect participants, we actually get really high response rates. Our average is about 60%, which is really good for academic medicine. But yeah, we have some schools who get into the 80% response rate zone.
Wow.
It's incredible. And so a lot of schools will use this as well in multiple iterations to measure their progress over time. And we have seen in our research statistically significant jumps in areas where schools put in action plans in place and where they put resources in place. Faculty and staff perceptions have gotten better over time, and retention's improved over time, which is really the point of doing this work.
So you're saying that when institutions engage with the AAMC on this standpoint engagement survey, not only does it help get a true measure of what your employees, your faculty and staff are perceiving and experiencing, but then it's benchmarked against other institutions and yourself so that you can do the trend analysis over time. And then when you're talking about improvements or these jumps, Valerie, maybe we can get to it a little bit later, but I'm wondering what are the interventions they're doing? Do you also consult with the institutions that say, hey, Kim, here's your data. You want to jump on a call and we'll meet and talk about it. And gosh, we've noticed this or that. And as you think about opportunities to move that needle, you might want to, do you have that? Is that level of feedback, Valerie?
Yeah, absolutely. So exactly as you said, the benchmarking within the survey is not only across the different departments or faculty subgroups, but also benchmarking with a large national benchmark. Schools of all different sizes, missions, all across the U.S., and as kind of the process of participating in the program, I will come in once the data's been all crunched, and I will actually consult with deans and dean's office leadership, department chairs, about what to do with this data. What is it really saying? How to make those improvements? And additionally, faculty affairs leaders like yourself will pull all of the schools participating in Standpoint together a couple times a year to share those promising practices about what is working in terms of interventions.
Love it. Promising practice. I like that better than best practices. Promising practices. Love it. How often do institutions administer? Is it annually, every 2 years? What do you recommend?
Yeah, so we generally recommend every 2 to 3 years. We want to make sure that folks have enough time to implement solutions and for them to really take hold before reassessing. So yeah, most schools are on a 2 to 3 year cycle.
And how did that work with COVID? I mean, was there a pause on it? Because I know here at Hopkins, the first thing is people are like, our faculty are over-surveyed anyway. No, every time somebody says, hey, how about we survey? People are like, no surveys. So survey fatigue is, first of all, like always important thing. But gosh, when COVID hit or any other big events, disruptive events at an institution, folks might be a little hesitant. This might not be the best time to be doing a survey, given the fact that ABC just happened, or we know that 1, 2, 3 is coming down the line in the financial model or the leadership turnover. How do you also maneuver those kind of things, like, pandemics and big changes that might kind of make people nervous about the data?
Yeah, absolutely. So, there was a slight dip in our participation during COVID, but we actually still had a number of schools surveyed during that time. Our recent national report that came out this past July had 25 medical schools in our sample that surveyed between March of 2020 and the end of the calendar year of 2022. So we still had a pretty good group, about 18,000 full and part-time faculty respond during that period.
Wowee. Wow. And I imagine the data, probably, both quantitative and qualitative data would reflect the circumstances or the ecosystem. And so it's, of course, that's like a big footnote or caveat with the administration and then analyses of these data. But, you're right. It doesn't change the fact that, the data still show something. I mean, we would have, imagine any kind of a trend analysis where one might see a blip or a big mark in this and like, oh, people go, oh my gosh, what happened there? Oh, that's right. That was that COVID thing. So that's could explain some of the changes, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting in terms of the data that we saw collected during that period. We actually saw overall faculty engagement go up, even though other things like burnout severely increased during the COVID period, of course. But, academic medicine is an advocation, and everyone rallied, around this situation and became very engaged. And leadership was doing a really great job of communicating regularly with faculty and staff during COVID, which I think also helped boost engagement.
That's really smart observation, Valerie. Yes. So I like that maybe our instincts would be to hypothesize that, oh no, we can't possibly do this because it's going to be, deep gloom, disaster, despair. And, yes, and like you said, the silver linings that we all talked about, that kind of came through and were unanticipated consequences. I always give the example of my clinician and healthcare practitioner friends who would say and bemoan the fact that we could never do telehealth. They'd always say, no, can't do telehealth, can't do telehealth. And then all of a sudden COVID hit, and guess what happened? They were doing telehealth. So, like, isn't that funny how when all of a sudden we needed to, we could do it? So it's
Yeah.
those things of like, wait a minute, let's absolutely be thinking critically about why in initiating a survey experience might be tricky, but also let's be open to possibilities of folks are maybe staying home and really rethinking priorities. And maybe, this place isn't such a bad place after all. And gosh, I can't believe how everybody rallied and what a great school of medicine I work in. And are my leaders really, stepping up? This is awesome. So any, like in any life, any kind of like micro level, macro level, big events give us pause to kind of recalibrate and think about things. So you're exactly, I think that's a really smart observation. Can you give us the lowdown on like trends? I want to know what are we, I mean, I talk to leaders, I talk to people like you all the time, and yet it's hard to kind of get the even bigger, helicopter view of what's happening. And then by the time we wait for the publications that come out and like the wonderful webinars, and I clicked into the one of our Texas consortium friends that we had that wonderful presentation on the offices of faculty affairs and faculty development. So, I mean, I kind of see those things, but it's this stuff is hot off the press. So, what have you observed most recently?
Sure. A couple of interesting trends. So, in addition to the boost in engagement, there are a couple of key areas where we saw some interesting findings. One of the topics covered in Standpoint is whether or not faculty receive mentorship, both formal and informal. And we've seen in our most recent analysis, but over the years have seen as well, that having a formal mentor, whether that's in your department, the medical school, or even from a professional society, those individuals with a formal mentor are more engaged, more satisfied, and more likely to stay at their institution compared to those individuals that don't receive formal mentoring. And that, as faculty affairs professionals, that's our bread and butter, right? And it really does make a difference. Some of the other things that we have seen that were occurring before COVID, but continued and have actually kind of changed a little bit, has to do with sexual harassment and disrespect. We are all aiming to build equitable and inclusive environments. And we know harassment, is occurring at our schools and is something that we can help solve. And in terms of the statistics, about 1 in 3 women are experiencing gender harassment on a regular basis within academic medicine, compared to about 1 in 8 men. So it's important to emphasize that this is experienced by all individuals, both men and women. And the
And
AAMC.
this is not only faculty, but you're saying it's staff. Remember, you're reminding us that this is, or is this just faculty?
That's faculty. Staff has experiences harassment at a little bit lower rates. They're reporting a little bit lower rates based on our survey, but still, yeah. I mean, it's a we all know this is a zero tolerance issue, but we actually did put out a report about 2 years ago now using the standpoint data and looking at incidents of sexual harassment across specialties. So that's also available on our website.
Oh, so I can I just like pause here for a moment and say,
Sure.
are you kidding? Look, this is
Yeah.
now 2024, and one in three women have reported gender harassment. I just still, again, like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
2024. I can't understand this. I just really can't. I can't wrap my head around it. And it's just kind of like what you said, like the mentorship, of course. I feel like, and maybe it says part of my age or just my extreme impatience, but I feel like, yes, mentorship is associated with increased engagement, satisfaction, retention. Yes, we have decades now of literature showing this. How come, and many of our faculty hear hop and say, I don't have a mentor. How do I find a mentor? And it's kind of always this, like, bang head here. Really? I don't, I just, help me, Valerie. Help me understand how we're still not doing enough mentoring and we're not doing it well. And help me understand why we're still harassing each other. What is going on?
I think we've got, obvious barriers as it pertains to formal mentorship. I think people are incredibly strapped for time. We know that. And participating in mentorship does take time, right, for to have a good relationship, both on the part of the mentor and the mentee. And it's, we really need to get our department leaders to prioritize the professional development of their employees.
So,
So that means making time for mentorship.
yeah, I mean, a hard stop on what you just said. We really need to make sure our department leaders invest in their faculty members and invest in the development of their faculty members. I mean, y'all can rewind this and hear this and state it more verbatim than I just did. That is just, I'm gonna, that statement should stand by itself. Our poor department chairs, because now I'm going to flip it around here, directors, it's all money. I mean, they are so, our institutions are so strapped financially that they, from the top down, they're not, I imagine the conversations with the deans and the presidents of the university aren't like, listen, folks, our number one priority is to develop our faculty and our staff, and I want all hands on deck. Everybody needs mentors. We got to help develop them professionally, career fulfilling, and I doubt that ever comes across their lips. Or if it does, it's at the bottom of the agenda. It's always about solvency and RVUs and being productive on spreadsheets. So thank you for underlining, bolding the basics, as you call it, the bread and butter of what we do. You, if your faculty, if your staff are not fully engaged in their work, you're not going to get the spreadsheet dollars. That's the, I mean, how come they don't understand that? That they want the outcome, they want the money, but they don't understand like what gets that? You have to have people who want to do that produce, right?
Right. And mentoring, people want a mentor for various reasons. In our survey, we ask for those folks who don't have a mentor, what would be reasons that they would want to participate in a formal mentoring relationship? And one of those reasons is learning to start or continue research, which does have operational implications, right? You are absolutely correct. Our schools have such financial pressures, and making time for this professional development is really important. There are productivity outcomes, as well as, the tried and true mentorship in helping folks think about their career development. It also keeps them wanting to stay and develop their careers at that institution. And we know retention's expensive. So, all of the faculty development, the leadership development that we offer has business sense to it. aside from just making good sense and being part of our mission.
Wow. Amen. So to the thank you, that makes me feel better. I'm exhaling now. How do we know about the harassment angle? Is this a remnant or just kind of the residual of people of a certain generation being perpetrators? I guess I'm sounding a little bit ageist, maybe. I'm being an ist here, but are the younger generations less tolerant of this? So is there hope that the new wave of early career faculty members, the new wave of our future leaders, are they like, oh no, we got this. It's all y'all who've been here a long time who don't get it. Am I being pie in the sky, or does it happen across the board?
You know, it happens across the board, Kim. Mm-hmm. And harassment is one of those issues that we need to constantly monitor and address in building inclusive workplace environments. You know, everyone needs the education about what harassment is and is not. And in the digital age in particular, harassment, you know, has looked a little differently. It occurs over Zoom. There are still, you know, people regardless of age, you know, gender put down, sharing of obscene images, using vulgar terms, you know, that is across age groups. Now, people who are younger, maybe they are reporting it more frequently, but, you know, I don't know that that's the case. I think it affects everyone the same way, and that, you know, we're perpetrators are perpetrators regardless of age, unfortunately.
All right. Okay. So let me push back here. I'm a woman, Valerie. I'm not being harassed. I don't need to know about this. What do I need to learn about this stuff for? It doesn't affect me. I'm fine. Thank you very much. Why is it important that I know this and know about it?
Yeah, I think it's important for you both as an educator, as a leader, and also if you have mentees.
Boom. Yeah. I get that question too. That doesn't affect me. It's kind of like people use a metaphor of, why do I need to do the hand washing, my learning module? I don't see patients. Why do I need to do the translator module, how to get someone to translate language? I don't see patients. That I can kind of like, well, yeah, I get it. But this is something like, well, why do I need to learn about, you know, equity, inclusion, diversity? I'm none of those. It doesn't affect me. I'm fine. Yes, and how about opening our eyes to what's happening elsewhere to other people, or your people you work with or are training are the perpetrators of this, that we are obligated to stand up for injustice no matter where it is and what it looks like and where it's happening, right? So that's kind of my comeback too, is like, yeah, and yes, and yes, and.
And, you know, in the clinical environment, there have been many studies showing the harassment of patients, patients being the perpetrators and harassing physicians and trainees, you know, alike. So, I mean, we are not exempt to these experiences, unfortunately, you know, regardless of setting.
Right. And what I like and appreciate about it is I can learn some language to support my peers. So I happen to be a white female, so I may not experience some things that my friends and colleagues may, and I want to be able to have the voice and use the right posture and stance to then advocate and say, oh no, not in this house. That's not how we behave here. So I don't know sometimes the right way to do that. So that's another, I think, a value of our learning about that. But anyway, I'm getting on the soapbox. So back to the trend. So engagement, we're talking about mentorship and the value of increasing engagement, satisfaction, retention. We're bummed out to learn that another trend is still the 1 in 3 women, 1 in 8 men reporting sexual harassment and disrespect. What else?
So I'd also really like to touch on retention. Mm-hmm. You know, we constantly monitor what are the reasons people are leaving. And if people expect to be either leaving their school in the next 1 to 2 years, they plan on retiring, or if they plan on leaving academic medicine as the field. And some of the things we're seeing around reasons for leaving one's institution and perhaps changing to another, people are seeking equitable compensation and benefits, and comp and benefits that reflect the current reality, needing childcare, the rising of the cost of living, burnout and workplace balance, wellness. That is a huge reason that people have been changing positions, as well as whether or not they've got opportunities for growth. You know, is there a path of advancement for them at their current institution? So those are just some of the reasons that people are considering leaving. And one of the things that we see, and it's intuitive, but seeing it in the data is important. One's relationship with their direct supervisor is a huge driver of retention. Having a supervisor that listens to them, that is supportive of their career development, make sure that they have time for, not only clinical work, but the teaching and research mission. Those are all really important things that a supervisor provides for their employees.
You're right, Valerie. People don't leave bad jobs necessarily. They leave bad bosses. So, Valerie, you're pointing that out, all the more important for at institutions, back to the bread and butter analogy, to invest in leadership training and development and professionalism and providing leaders and faculty members with the skills and the competencies to have that high emotional intelligence and to help their colleagues see opportunity and to navigate. So yeah, again, this stuff doesn't happen accidentally. Sometimes I guess it happens accidentally if you were just so fortunate to have someone who has developed these wonderful leadership skills. But this is teachable, trainable, coachable stuff. I mean,
Right.
we can't necessarily kind of say, well, we have a bad batch of leaders, or we have to wait till we have some turnover. No, we can invest in, we can all, we're all smart people. We all got here after a lot of education. We can learn some skills, some tools. As a coach, we always learn, one of the mantras is, what's the smallest change you can make that would have the biggest impact? So we can all make little tweaks that would have potentially, really great impacts for us and for others, right?
Absolutely. And Kim, I would be remiss if I didn't mention a topic that I think is important to the both of us, which is also retirement. As you mentioned our earlier studies a few years ago on retirement, we know the academic medicine workforce is aging. Based on our Standpoint surveys data, we see 12% of faculty saying they are likely to retire in the next 1 to 2 years. And in some other studies that I've been conducting recently on medical educators, specifically those in basic science departments, they are also an aging population that is saying they plan to retire soon. So when we think about our workforce, we really need to be paying attention to who are the teachers of tomorrow, and how do we bring in trainees, and keep them at our institutions to become faculty members.
You're so right, Valerie. Thanks for reminding me of that. And you remember years ago that we added in a couple questions about caregiving. And you mentioned caregiving earlier, and that was in the vein of younger families, I presume, who have little babies and want to have, they have some take care of those babies. But guess what? On the opposite end of the life continuum, we have faculty members who are telling us in our Department of Medicine most recently last year, I surveyed 36% of the faculty who responded to our survey said that they are caring for someone with a disability or who needs a mom, a dad, a mother-in-law, father-in-law, or a husband, wife, or a partner. So, yes, in terms of the estimated shortfalls of positions in the coming years, and given the fact that Valerie Dandar is just reporting that 12% of these 18,000 respondents said that they might retire or thinking of retiring in the next 1 to 2 years, what might help encourage, if possible, them to stay or be more vital or engaged? Part of that is maybe addressing the fact that they have these tension points and these pools of caregiving if we could do something to help mitigate the stressors and time required to take care of moms and dads and partners. And some of these moms and dads, as we know, are around the world. They're not down the block and around the corner. That might free up some space to continue in our institutions. I'm not saying don't care for mom and dad. We do take care of them. But I'd run a monthly Zoom meeting with physician and scientist investigators who are caring for moms and dads and partners. And it's, and you hear it all the time. They're doing, it's like a part-time job. You know, they're on the phone with other states and caregivers in other states or other countries trying to arrange care and do, you know, medication dispensing and all the minutia. So there are lots of interesting dynamics that happen, of course, across a faculty life's sphere, but you and I saw in our research that this is becoming even more important, our aging population, where they're going to go and how they're going to go and how, what's the best way to support them and our institutions. So thanks for raising that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think lastly, that just the one thing I would touch on, and again, you know, we all know this, but having the hard numbers to support is always important for advocacy reasons, especially burnout increased during the pandemic. We saw that through our Standpoint results in this most recent report. And women are significantly more burned out than their men colleagues. In our research, 38% of women reported experiencing one or more symptoms of burnout, some, you know, to the point where they needed to seek assistance, compared to about 26% of men.
Yeah, gosh, Valerie, 38% of women, one or more symptoms compared to, you said 38%?
38, yes.
Yeah, 38% of women reported one or more symptoms of burnout, and men, 26% reported one or more. And this kind of makes me think, you know, back in my back in the day of my aging research, we learned, you know, we saw through many, many epidemiologic studies that women were had higher rates or report higher rates of depressive symptomatology, for example. And so, you know, you wonder if part of this is, are women more likely to report that they're having burnout symptoms, whereas men are like, no, I'm tough. I'm not going to, you know, I'm fine. Yes, but your limb is, you know, hanging up. No, it's fine. It's just a flesh wound. It's fine. I'm okay. So is it part of the socialization that men are less apt to report it, and or that women have more, carry more responsibility or assume more responsibility? And, you know, regardless, if they're reporting it, that's reality. And so, yeah, what are we going to do about it? Something, one of those things where I just go, ah, but the facts are what the facts are. If women are reporting gender harassment and disrespect, facts are. So what are we going to do about this stuff? Like, what about burnout? Let's stick on burnout for a minute here. What do you tell folks?
Yeah. And you know, burnout, one of the things that I think is important from our data is that we're seeing burnout not only in clinicians, but also in basic scientists, you know, and the reasons behind their burnout is a little bit different, but it is ubiquitous in academic medicine. You know, for some of our basic science and clinical scientists, you know, the pressure, the economic pressures that we talked about earlier to generate and receive grant funding is a big kind of pressure for them. Obviously, clinicians, there are, you know, there's a wide variety and well documented in the literature some of the things they're facing. But, you know, Kim, to your point, being in workplace environments that are where people are also experiencing disrespect, et cetera, that is also contributing to their burnout. One of the things that I have been talking with some colleagues in the AAMC's Council for Faculty and Academic Societies. We've been talking about the value of learning communities and bringing institutions together to identify who is able to tackle this issue. What are the interventions that they're putting into place, and how can we share and adapt them for our needs across our different institutions.
Yeah. I mean, I was just talking with Johnson George, as we both know and love him, an incoming GFA president. And he was talking and boosting the mentoring circles. And I think, you know, Luann Thorndike and a bunch of our colleagues back in the day, and you were, you know, instrumental in getting those started and talking about the value of the mentoring circles. And so when you're saying these learning communities, it makes me have the same feeling, which my career mission mantra is always to build community, that together we're stronger. Because one person sitting in an institution or one faculty member listening to you right now, Valerie Dandor, might be like, well, oh my gosh, well, how am I going to do this? How am I going to fix mentoring at my institution or my division or my department or my center or my office or my clinic? How am I going to fix sexual harassment and disrespect? How am I going to handle retention and retirement and burnout? Here's the answer. You're not. But there's a whole family and community of people who do have, as you said so lovely, promising practices, best practices, promising practices, who have developed good programs, and they're there. So you don't have to ever invent stuff yourself, that we are all tackling these problems. Hence, you know, your data, this is not unique to one place. We all struggle with it. So there are these learning communities are wonderful places to kind of at least go together and go, oh, phew, it's not just me, my faculty, my staff, my school. All right. So now I'm not fighting this battle alone. There's a whole army of people who are all trying to tackle this. So very good advice, the learning communities.
Yeah. And the other thing, Kim, you know, the AAMC, we see ourselves as conveners and also able to communicate with schools and identify those promising practices. So a number of publications we've put out recently, they're actually entitled Promising Practices for Addressing and Understanding Sexual Harassment, Promising Practices for Addressing Faculty Engagement. And in each of those publications, we actually do have case studies from institutions with novel, strong programs. So helping to share that across the board. So those can be found on the AAMC website. They're free for anyone who's interested.
Oh my gosh, love it. Yep, here we are. Scholarly articles for AANC promising practices. Oh, yeah, a whole bunch of them. Underrepresentation of women in science, sexual orientation, gender curriculum. There's a whole bunch here. Oh, this is so helpful. See, this is a value of being involved with or minimally aware of a professional society where the work has been done, that we are building on shoulders of wonderful giants through our history. That I will always feel badly when I meet a new faculty member who has accepted a wonderful new role of, you know, vice chair for faculty development or vice chair for mentoring or vice chair for promotions. And they're like, I'm all about this, Kim. I heard you do this kind of stuff in your office. So I'm thinking of like doing the survey to kind of, and I'm maybe this, maybe that. And I'm like, okay, hang on a second. This is like any scientific field of inquiry. There's a whole literature around this. I mean, there are hundreds of people who've done this. And they look at me like, really? And so I kind of go, oh, that's again, the head banging thing of, yes, we've been here before. This is a thing. Don't start anything new. Go get into the literature. The AAMC has tons of resources around this. There are communities of people who live and breathe this stuff. So yeah, thanks. Well, this has been wonderful, Valerie. I'm going to leave kind of some parting words from you. Whatever you'd like to share about Standpoint, about AAMC, about any kind of instincts or hypotheses or exciting work coming down the line that you'd like to share with the community. That's all in your hands, Valerie.
Sure. Thanks, Kim. I think I'll, you know, on the topic of faculty engagement and retention, I think I'll close by saying, you know, engagement is rooted and aligned with really important positive organizational outcomes. Those faculty who are engaged, they're not only more productive and dedicated to their institutions, they're more likely to stay. And in the literature, we've seen those who are engaged provide better patient care and have higher patient satisfaction rates. So engagement is not just touchy-feely, it has business outcomes associated with it. So really, assessing engagement is critical for academic medicine. In terms of some things coming down the pike, I'm very excited. My partner, Diana Lautenberger, who is our director for gender equity initiatives at the WAMC, she and I are working on a new publication, the 2024 State of Women in Medicine and Science. And that will be coming out probably late spring. And have all updated statistics on women in medicine and science throughout the medical education continuum.
Whoa, huge news. Folks, so much going on at the AAMC. If you don't know how you can get in touch or learn anything more about AAMC, you got to email Valerie Dander, V Dander, DANDAR, at AAMC.org. VDANDAR at AAMC.org. Go to the AAMC.org website. There's so much there. So www.aamc.org. All right. This has been Valerie Dander. Isn't she wonderful? The Director of Medical School Operations at the AAMC. Valerie, as usual, thank you so much. I always learn so much from you. You do great work. Thank you for supporting us and the best faculty in the galaxy. Appreciate you.
Thanks so much, Kim. Been a pleasure today.
Hey everyone, it's your podcast producer Casey. Just wanted to let you know that as of March 1st, 2024, this podcast has had nearly 89,000 total downloads and YouTube views from listeners in 95 different countries. The website, facultyfactory.org, has drawn over 41,000 web visits from users in 122 different countries. I tell you all of this just to underscore the point that this truly is an international platform, and we want to invite you, no matter where you are in the world, to be a guest on our show. Our host, Dr. Skorupski, makes the experience very engaging, relaxing, and fun. As producer, I'll make any of the edits that you might need on the back end before we publish it. We want to hear from different faculty around the world and learn from each other, so please reach out if you'd like to be a guest or to nominate someone in our academic medicine community to be a guest. You can visit the Contact Us page on facultyfactory.org to send us a message, or contact Dr. Skorupski directly at kskorupski@jhmi.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to Faculty Factory Podcast. The mission of the Faculty Factory is to build and support a community of leaders in faculty development who share tools, resources, wisdom, and encouragement in service to our faculty members, schools, and institutions. We encourage you to go to facultyfactory.org to find out more, get in touch with me, ask me any questions. Maybe you want to be interviewed on the podcast. Thanks for tuning in to Faculty Factory Podcast. We'll see you next time.
The Faculty Factory Podcast and website is sponsored by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine Office of Faculty. For more information, visit facultyfactory.org.